A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what the most rigorous and advanced forms of multi-factor authentication look like, specifically in government and high-security environments. He's imagining a scenario where someone's working remotely with sensitive information, no secure compartmentalized facility available, and the authentication needs go way beyond standard two-factor. What does the deep end of MFA actually entail?
This is one of those topics where the gap between what people think is strong security and what government systems actually require is genuinely vast. Most people hear two-factor authentication and picture getting a text message with a 6-digit code. That's the shallow end of the pool.
The kiddie pool with floaties and a lifeguard who's not really paying attention.
And the prompt is asking about the other end. The deep ocean trench where they're verifying not just that you know a password and have a phone, but that you are physically, cryptographically, behaviorally you. So let's start with what the U government actually uses. The gold standard for federal authentication is something called PIV, Personal Identity Verification, and its military counterpart, the Common Access Card, or CAC.
The smart card that every federal employee and contractor has to badge into buildings with.
Right. But it's much more than a visual ID. These cards contain a cryptographic chip, essentially a tiny computer, that stores your digital certificates, your private keys, biometric data like fingerprints, and a PIN. When you insert the card into a reader and into your PIN, what's happening under the hood is a cryptographic challenge response. The system sends a random number, the card signs it with your private key, and the server verifies it with your public key. That's fundamentally different from typing in a code from an app.
The PIN never leaves the card. The private key never leaves the card. It's all happening locally on silicon that's been certified to resist tampering.
That certification process is brutal. These chips have to pass FIPIPS 142 or 143 validation, Federal Information Processing Standards. They test for physical tamper resistance, side channel attacks, electromagnetic leakage, you name it. If someone tries to decap the chip and probe it with a microscope, the chip is designed to self-destruct.
Which is a phrase that never gets old.
And I want to be precise about what multi-factor means in this context. In IST's special publication 800-63, which is the Bible for Federal Digital Identity, defines three authentication factors. Something you know, like a password or PIN. Something you have, like a cryptographic token or smart card. Something you are, like a fingerprint or iris scan. PIV plus PIN gives you two of those. But at higher assurance levels, they start layering.
Let's back up and talk about those assurance levels, because I think that's where most people's mental model breaks down. ONIST defines three levels now. ONAAL1, AAL2, AAL3. What's the difference?
Under the latest revision, ONIST SP800-634, which was published in December of 2024 and is now in its final public comment phase before becoming mandatory, the framework has been refined. Authenticator Assurance Level 1 is basically what most commercial services use, single factor plus some phishing resistance maybe. AAL2 requires two distinct factors and cryptographic proof of possession. AAL3 is where things get serious. It requires hardware-based authenticators, verifier impersonation resistance, and what they call demonstrating possession of the key through a cryptographic protocol.
Verifier impersonation resistance. That's a mouthful. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means the authenticator can't be tricked by a fake login page. With standard two-factor, if I set up a phishing site that looks exactly like your bank, you type in your password, I forward it to the real bank sends you an SMS code, you type that into my fake site, I forward it to the real bank, and now I'm in. Verifier impersonation resistance breaks that chain. The cryptographic hardware checks that it's talking to the legitimate domain before it even generates a response.
The authenticator itself is verifying the server, not just the other way around.
And this is where FIDO2 comes in. FIDO2 is the standard developed by the FIDO Alliance, which includes Google, Microsoft, Apple, Yubico, and basically everyone serious about authentication. It uses WebAuthn as the browser API, and CTAP as the protocol between the authenticator and the client. When you use a FIDO2 security key, the key stores a unique private key for every website you register with. The public key is sent to the server during registration. During login, the server sends a challenge that includes its own domain name, and the key will only sign the response if the domain in the challenge matches the domain it registered with.
Even if I'm staring at a pixel-perfect replica of my agency's login portal, my security key knows it's being phished, and just...
doesn't even give the attacker a useful error message. And this is why the UK government has been aggressively moving toward FIDO2. The Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, they've all issued memoranda pushing for phishing-resistant MFAW. The Office of Management and Budget put out a memo in 2022 requiring federal agencies to implement phishing-resistant MFA, and that deadline was end of fiscal year 2024.
Phishing-resistant is doing a lot of work there. Because the dirty secret of most commercial two-factor is that it's not phishing-resistant at all. SMS codes, TOTP codes from authenticator apps, push notifications, all of them can be phished with enough sophistication.
They are, constantly. Every major breach in the last few years that involved credential theft, the attacker got past MFA because the MFA wasn't phishing-resistant. The Twitter breach in 2020, the Uber breach in 2022, the MGM Resorts breach in 2023. All of them involve social engineering that bypassed traditional two-factor.
The MGM one was brutal because they just called the help desk.
That's a whole different vector, and it connects to what the prompt is really getting at. The authentication system doesn't exist in a vacuum. You can have the most sophisticated cryptographic hardware in the world, and if someone can call your IT department and say, "I lost my token," convincingly enough, none of it matters. So when we talk about the most rigorous forms of MFA, we're talking about systems that are resilient not just to technical attacks, but to social engineering, to physical coercion, to insider threats.
Walk me through what an AAL3 government authentication flow actually looks like. I'm a remote worker, I need to access a classified system or a sensitive but unclassified system from home. What's the sequence?
You'd start with a government-furnished laptop that's been hardened, specific operating system image, full disk encryption, all the endpoint security agents installed. You plug in your PIV card or your CAC into a reader. Or increasingly, you're using a derived credential on a mobile device or a FIDO2 key that's been issued through the same PKI infrastructure.
PKI being public key infrastructure, the entire system of certificate authorities that vouch for who owns which public keys.
So you insert your card, you enter your PIN, that's the something you know factor, the card itself is the something you have factor. But at AAL3, that's not always enough. You might also need to provide a biometric, a fingerprint scan on the card reader itself, or a facial recognition match against the photo stored on the card's chip. That's your something, your factor.
That fingerprint matching happens locally, on the reader, not on some server somewhere.
Correct. Match on card or match on reader. The biometric template never leaves the device. This is a really important architectural principle in high security MFAA. You don't want a central database of fingerprints because that's a catastrophic single point of failure. If someone breaches that database, you can't exactly issue people new fingers.
Unlike a password, lose a password database, you force a reset. Lose a fingerprint database, you've permanently compromised the biometric for every affected user across every system they'll ever use.
This is why the government's approach to biometrics is fundamentally different from what you see in consumer devices. Apple's Face ID or Touch ID, those are convenience features. They're good. They're well-engineered, but they're not designed to meet the NIST 863B requirements for biometric performance at AAL3. At AAL3, the false match rate has to be extremely low. We're talking 1 in a million or better, and the presentation attack detection has to be robust.
Presentation attack detection. That's the system's ability to tell if someone is holding up a photo or a silicone mask instead of a real face.
And the state of the art here is pretty wild. High-end government systems don't just check the geometry of your face, they check for liveness, micro-movements, blood flow, pupil dilation in response to light changes. Some systems project structured light patterns onto your face and analyze the distortion to confirm three-dimensionality. The iPhone does a simpler version of this with its dot projector, but government-grade systems go much further.
We've got PIN, smart card, biometric. That's three factors, but I know some environments go further than that. What about location-based factors? What about behavioral factors?
This is where we enter what's sometimes called step-up authentication, or continuous authentication. The idea is that a single authentication event at login isn't sufficient for the highest security environments. The system should continuously verify that the person using the device is still the authorized user and that nothing suspicious is happening.
The musical equivalent of a security guard who doesn't just check your ID at the door, but follows you around the building, periodically asking to see it again.
Watches how you walk, what you reach for, whether you seem nervous. Behavioral biometrics is a rapidly growing field. The system builds a profile of how you type, your keystroke dynamics, your typing rhythm, the pressure you apply, even the angle at which you hold your phone. If someone else sits down at your laptop, even if they have your password and your token, the system can detect the anomaly because they don't type like you.
How reliable is that, really? I'm skeptical of behavioral biometrics because people's behavior changes. You're tired. You're caffeinated. You injured your hand. You're typing from a weird angle on a plane.
That's a completely fair skepticism, and it's one of the reasons behavioral biometrics are typically used as a risk signal rather than a hard gate. They're not going to lock you out because you're typing slightly differently after a long weekend. But if the keystroke pattern is radically different, and that coincides with the login from an unusual location, and the time of day is unusual, those signals compound.
It's not the typing doesn't match, denied. It's the typing doesn't match, and three other things are also weird. Let's require an additional authentication step.
Right, step-up authentication. It's the principle of adaptive MFA. The system calculates a risk score based on dozens of factors. Device posture, is the antivirus up to date? Is the OS patched? Is the firewall enabled? Network context, are you connecting from an IP address that's associated with known threats? Geolocation, are you logging in from a country you've never visited? Time-based, is it 3A in your time zone?
If the risk score crosses a threshold, the system demands more proof. Maybe it sends a push notification. Maybe it requires a biometric reauthentication. Maybe it triggers a video call with a security officer.
In the most sensitive environments, that last one is absolutely a thing. There are systems where, if the automated authentication raises flags, a human security operator initiates a live video call. They verify your face, they ask you challenge questions that aren't in any database, things that only you would know, maybe based on your work context from earlier that day. What was the subject line of the last email you sent before logging off?
That's getting into espionage novel territory, but it makes sense. If the automated system can't resolve the anomaly, you escalate to a human who can exercise judgment.
This connects to another dimension of high assurance authentication that doesn't get enough attention. The provisioning process. How did you get that PIV card or that security key in the first place? The most sophisticated authentication technology in the world is meaningless if the identity proofing was weak.
Right, the garbage in, garbage out of identity. If I can walk into an issuing office with a fake ID and get a real PIV card, I've just bypassed the entire system.
This is why the identity proofing requirements at higher assurance levels are so stringent. On IST 800-2063A defines identity assurance levels, IAL1, IAL2, IAL3. At IAL2, you need to provide government-issued photo ID and verify that you physically possess it, either in person or through a supervised remote process. At IAL3, it's in-person only, with biometric verification. A trained operator examines your identity documents, verifies the security features, compares your face to the photo, and captures your biometrics.
The authentication chain starts long before you ever log in. It starts with a human being physically verifying that you are who you claim to be, in a controlled environment, with document forensics.
That's the part that's hardest to replicate remotely, which is exactly what the prompt is getting at. Short of inspecting our physical security and verifying our identity in person, that's the constraint. And the honest answer is that for the absolute highest levels of assurance, you can't fully eliminate the need for in-person verification, but you can get remarkably close.
What does remarkably close look like? If I'm that remote worker and I can't go to a processing center for IL3 identity proofing, what's the best the government can do?
There's a concept called derived credentials. You take a high assurance credential that was issued through an in-person process, like a CAC or PIV card, and you derive a new credential from it that can be used on a mobile device. The derivation process requires you to physically possess the original card and enter the PIN, so the trust is inherited. You're not starting from scratch.
The in-person step happened once, maybe when you were onboarded at headquarters, and then you can generate derived credentials that carry that trust forward into remote work scenarios.
And the derived credential approach is becoming more important as remote and hybrid work becomes permanent in many government roles. The National Security Agency and CISA have both published guidance on derived credentials. The key requirement is that the derived credential has to be stored in a hardware-backed key store, like the secure enclave on an iPhone or the trusted execution environment on an Android device. You can't just store it in software.
Because if it's in software, malware can extract it. If it's in a hardware security module, even if the OS is compromised, the key is still protected.
And this is the same principle behind FIDO2 security keys. The private key never leaves the secure element. The signing operation happens inside the chip, and only the result is sent out. Even if your computer is riddled with malware, the attacker can't extract the key.
Let's talk about those FIDO2 keys for a minute, because they've become the standard for phishing-resistant MFA across both government and industry. What makes a YubiKey or a similar device different from, say, using your phone as a FIDO2 authenticator?
The fundamental difference is the security model. A phone is a general-purpose computing device with an enormous attack surface. The operating system, the apps, the radios, the baseband processor. Apple and Google have done impressive work hardening their secure enclaves, and for most use cases, using a phone as a FIDO2 authenticator is perfectly fine. But for the highest assurance scenarios, you want a dedicated security key that does exactly one thing and has the smallest possible attack surface.
A device whose entire purpose is to say, yes, I am this key, and here is a cryptographic signature to prove it.
No browser, no email client, no apps. The firmware is minimal and can be formally verified. Some of the high-end government-grade keys are built on FIPS, validated hardware, and undergo regular penetration testing. They're also designed to be tamper-evident. If someone physically opens the device, it's obvious and the keys are wiped.
I've also read about some of these keys having additional protections, like requiring a physical touch to authorize each operation. So even if malware on your laptop tries to silently authenticate, it can't, because the key won't sign anything until you physically press the button.
That's called user presence verification, and it's part of the FIDO2 spec. There's also user verification, which is a step up. The key itself requires a PIN or a biometric before it'll operate. On some keys, you enter the PIN directly on the key's built-in keypad, so it never passes through the potentially compromised host computer.
That's clever. The PIN entry happens on a device that has no malware surface.
For environments where even that isn't enough, there are keys that incorporate on-device fingerprint readers. Your fingerprint unlocks the key performs the cryptographic operation, and the host never sees your fingerprint or your PIN.
If we're building up the stack for our hypothetical remote government worker, we've got a hardened laptop, a FIPS-validated FIDO2 key with biometric unlock, and a derived PIV credential. What else gets layered on?
Network-level authentication. In government environments, you're often not connecting directly to the application. You're first connecting through a VP on that requires its own authentication, often a separate certificate installed on your device, sometimes a separate token. Then you're authenticating to the network itself, which may use 802.1x with certificate-based authentication. Then you're authenticating to the application. Each layer has its own authentication requirements, and they're often using different factors.
Defense in depth applied to identity. Even if someone compromises one layer, they can't automatically traverse to the next.
This is where the concept of zero trust comes in, which has become the dominant security architecture for government systems. The Biden administration's executive order 14028 in 2021 mandated that federal agencies move towards zero trust architectures. The core principle is never trust, always verify. Every access request is evaluated independently. Just because you authenticated to the network doesn't mean you're trusted to access a particular application. Just because you accessed that application 5 minutes ago doesn't mean you're trusted now.
Zero trust extends to the device itself. The system isn't just authenticating you. It's authenticating your device, your device's health, your device's compliance with security policies.
This is what's called device attestation. Before you're granted access, the system checks, is the device encrypted? Is the OS patched to the latest version? Is the antivirus running and updated? Is the firewall enabled? Are there any known vulnerabilities? In government environments, this is often enforced through a NAC network access control solution that quarantines non-compliant devices.
The authentication isn't just, are you cool in the sloth? It's, are you cool in the sloth using the specific laptop assigned to cool in the sloth, which has been verified to be in a healthy and compliant state, connecting from an approved location during expected hours, exhibiting normal behavioral patterns?
If any of those signals deviates, the system responds. Maybe it denies access. Maybe it grants access but restricts what you can do. Read only, no downloads, no access to the most sensitive systems. Maybe it triggers an alert to the security operations center.
That's the kind of nuance that gets lost in the just use two-factor advice. The most advanced authentication systems aren't binary, access granted or denied. They're graduated. They make continuous risk-based decisions.
I want to mention one more dimension that's often overlooked, the auditing and logging. High-assurance authentication systems generate extensive logs. Every authentication attempt, successful or failed, is recorded with timestamps, IP addresses, device information, and the specific factors used. These logs feed into SIEM systems, security information, and event management that correlate events across the entire organization looking for anomalies.
Even if an attacker somehow manages to authenticate successfully, the act of doing so creates a forensic trail that can be analyzed later.
In many government systems, that analysis happens in near real time. If the same user authenticates from two geographically impossible locations within a short time window, the system flags it. If someone authenticates successfully but then exhibits unusual access patterns, accessing files they've never accessed before, downloading large amounts of data, the system can terminate the session midstream.
Let's talk about some of the more exotic factors that are emerging. I've read about systems that use gait analysis, the way you walk, as a continuous authentication factor. You carry a device, and it's measuring the rhythm and cadence of your steps.
Gait recognition has been researched for decades, mostly for surveillance applications, but it's starting to find its way into authentication. The accelerometer and gyroscope in your phone or your security badge can build a profile of your walking pattern. It's surprisingly distinctive, not as unique as a fingerprint, but distinctive enough to serve as a corroborating factor.
The beauty of it is that it's passive. You don't have to do anything. You just walk around, and the system continuously verifies that it's probably you.
There's also voice recognition as a continuous factor. Not just say this passphrase to unlock. That's active authentication. But passive voice analysis, where the system is continuously sampling audio during calls and verifying that the speaker is still the authorized user.
Which raises some unsettling privacy questions, but we're talking about government systems handling sensitive information. The privacy calculus is different than it is for consumer apps.
And it's important to note that in these environments, you have no expectation of privacy on your work device. Everything is monitored, everything is logged, and that's disclosed up front. You sign an agreement acknowledging it.
If we're synthesizing all of this, if someone asks me what the most rigorous MFA looks like, what's the one-sentence version?
It's a continuous, risk-adaptive, multi-layered system that combines hardware-backed cryptographic proof of possession, biometric verification performed locally on tamper-resistant silicon, device health attestation, behavioral analysis, and network context evaluation, all underpinned by identity proofing that involved in-person verification against government-issued documents.
That's a very Herman sentence.
I contain multitudes.
The thing that strikes me about all of this is how far it is from the consumer experience. Most people's interaction with them FA is, ugh, I have to pull out my phone and type in a code. And they find that annoying. Meanwhile, government systems are out here running silent, continuous biometric verification, analyzing your gait, and checking to make sure your laptop hasn't developed any new vulnerabilities since the last time you clicked a link.
That gap is actually a real problem because it shapes public perception of what security means. People think two-factor authentication is the ceiling, when it's really the floor. And when they hear about government security requirements, they don't have a mental model for why it needs to be so much more rigorous.
The other thing that jumps out is how much of this is about resilience rather than prevention. The goal isn't to build an impenetrable wall. It's to build a system that can detect when it's been breached, limit the damage, and generate the forensic evidence to understand what happened.
That's the zero trust philosophy in a nutshell. Design your authentication systems not to prevent every possible attack, because that's impossible, but to make successful attacks expensive, detectable, and limited in scope.
If our hypothetical remote worker is listening, and they're wondering what they should actually do, not what the NSA does, but what's practical for someone who handles sensitive information and wants to go beyond basic two-factor, what's the pragmatic advice?
First, get a FIDO2 security key. Not as a backup to your authenticator app, as your primary authentication method, with the app as the backup, register it everywhere that supports it. Second, enable device-level biometrics where available, understanding that on consumer devices these are convenience features, not high assurance factors, but they're still better than nothing. Third, use a password manager with a strong, unique master password, because the quality of your password still matters even with them FAA. Fourth, pay attention to the device health angle. Keep your operating system updated, use antivirus, enable your firewall.
If you're an organization trying to implement this for a remote workforce,
deploy certificate-based authentication through a mobile device management platform. Require device compliance checks before granting access. Implement adaptive access policies that evaluate risk signals. Move toward phishing-resistant MFA as your baseline, not your aspirational goal. And for your most sensitive systems, require hardware tokens with user verification.
The certificate-based piece is interesting because it eliminates passwords entirely for the end user. They authenticate with their device certificate, which is tied to the hardware, and they unlock it with a PIN or biometric. No password to phish, no password to forget, no password to reuse across sites.
Passwordless authentication is the direction everything is moving. Microsoft, Google, Apple, they're all pushing toward a world where passwords are a legacy fallback rather than the primary mechanism. And the government is moving that way too. The latest OnIST guidance strongly encourages phishing-resistant passwordless authentication at AAL2 and essentially requires it at AAL3.
Which is a long way from enter the 6-digit code we just texted you.
An SMS code is basically a post-it note stuck to the outside of your digital front door. It's better than nothing, but not by much.
All right, I think we've covered the landscape. Hardware tokens, smart cards, biometrics, behavioral analysis, device attestation, continuous authentication, zero trust, identity proofing. Anything major we missed?
One thing worth mentioning briefly, the supply chain security of the authenticators themselves. Government-grade hardware tokens go through a rigorous supply chain assurance process. You need to know that the token you're issuing to your employee wasn't tampered with between the factory and your hands. Some agencies require tokens to be shipped through controlled logistics channels, with tamper-evident packaging and serial number verification upon receipt.
Because the most sophisticated authentication system in the world is useless if someone intercepted your token in the mail and replaced it with one that looks identical but has a backdoor.
Security is a chain, and the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Sometimes that link is cryptographic, sometimes it's procedural, sometimes it's the mailroom.
The mailroom is always where these things fall apart.
Every heist movie ever made has taught us that.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
On the island of Réunion in the 1860s, French colonists practiced a dietary regimen known as Le Régime du Boucan, in which salted fish was buried in volcanic ash for 3 weeks before consumption. A surviving journal from a plantation doctor in 1863 describes the resulting dish as having, quote, the texture of cured leather, and the distinct aftertaste of cinders. Yet it was prescribed as a treatment for persistent digestive complaints.
They ate ash-cured fish to fix their stomach problems.
The logic is almost admirable in its circular wrongness.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.